Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is December 13th, 2021, and before introducing today's guest, I want to let listeners know there's a new version of the Econ Talk episode with Nina Krause about her book of Sound Mind. Some listeners detected annoying background noise, at least with their quality of hearing, so we've ironically perhaps put up a new edition of the episode. If you stop listening because of the noise, feel free to download the new and improved file. My guest today is Megan McArdle of The Washington Post. This is Megan's sixth appearance at Econ Talk. She was last here in March of 2021 talking about catastrophes and the pandemic. Megan, welcome back to Econ Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Our topic today is a little unusual. We're going to talk about the idea of home and the role of national identity in daily life and politics. And to do that, we're going to use a book by the late Roger Scruton as the basis for our conversation. That book is Where We Are. I found the book fascinating. It's his exploration of the Brexit vote, the nature of the British people, what it means to be British, English, UK-ish. And what was your reaction to the book, Megan?
I found it both very thought-provoking and often enlightening and also frustrating because, you know, as an American trained in a certain tradition, I kept trying to derive universal principles from what he was writing, and he kind of relentlessly refuses to let you do that. He keeps it very specifically about Britain and about the character of the British people. And what I realized towards the end was that this is a kind of a meta commentary on his subject, which is that there is no such thing as the pure universal brotherhood of man, that we are always in the end kind of bound by extremely particularist attachments to a particular place, a particular home, a particular people, and a particular kind of way of life. And that I think the pandemic has certainly has illustrated that better than anything could, where all of the people who thought that they were what one British writer called the somewheres versus the anywheres, you know, the people who live in one place and stay there versus the people who are constantly mobile and can go anywhere. Well, the anywhere has found themselves trapped somewhere. And it turned out that that national borders mattered a lot more than anything else. So I think it was a good time to be reading this book. And I feel like I'm not sure learned a lot is the right way to put it. I thought a lot.
Yeah, I found it very provocative. And in many, many different dimensions, because it ended up being about a lot of other things besides what you just nicely summarized. It is about that. I found it quite applicable. Maybe you will disagree, but I found it quite applicable to the United States and possibly to other countries. And we'll talk about that. But I want to start with the point you just raised about the somewheres versus the anywheres, because Scruton also evokes that comparison. And it reminded me of Chris Arnotti, Econ Talk guest, who also is dealing with similar issues somewhat in his book, The Importance of Place, and people who want to stay where they are even when economic opportunity has deserted that area. He talks about the contrast between the front row students and the back row students. He describes himself as a front row student, somebody who eager to do well, went on to get advanced education, and planned to live where the opportunity was greatest, where his physics degree would lead him, whether it was an academic life. Turned out it took him to Wall Street, far away from his home in Florida. And the anywheres, of which I am certainly one, and Scruton confesses that in some dimension, even though he's as English as can be, he is also an anywhere. He likes Germany. He likes
He lived in France
Italy.
For quite a long time.
Yeah, France. Right? Yeah. That's right. Not Italy, France. I think that's a really interesting way to think about differences. Of course, we're all a mix of both, but certainly the Brexit vote, which is part of what Scruton is writing about, was about the somewheres, the people who were rooted to the land of England, were in disagreement with the anywheres who felt, yeah, what's this big difference? So we're ruled. Yeah. So there's laws coming out of Brussels. So there's, you know, I want to be free to use my passport to move freely in Europe, ideally around the world. But yeah. the somewheres felt differently. What's your take on that distinction?
I have a lot of thoughts about this because I randomly had a very interesting experience with Brexit, which is that I went to a conference in Germany right before the Brexit vote. And in order to, in a somewhat quixotic quest to save Bloomberg money, I flew this incredibly circuitous route so that I could fly business class at coach prices. And as a result,
nice person, Megan.
It was actually funny because, you know, Bloomberg has so much money. And I told my editor this very proudly. And he was like, I appreciate your effort, but why? But it actually ended up being really good because what happened was I flew through a British airport called Luton, which is it's a sort of third tier airport. It's outside of London. I ended up staying overnight there in a really bad hotel. And on the return trip, I got trapped in a German airport. It was the former East German airport, which is like the worst airport. It's flown by EasyJet, which is an airline that I'm not sure we're supposed to endorse. I would never personally fly EasyJet again. It was quite an experience. And we ended up trapped in this airport by storms in London. And all of the young people are hogging the very, very few electric outlets. I found one that like a bunch of middle class, sort of normal Brits of middle age had colonized. And I sort of begged my way into the circle so that I could recharge my phone. And so I ended up spending like 8 hours with these people. We're sharing all the stuff we'd bought at the duty free and, you know, passing around bottles of wine. And it was a really interesting experience because I came out of it thinking, Brexit's going to happen. And I almost wrote the column that I was like, I can't just like generalize from these people I met in an airport. Had I done that, I would have had the Thomas Friedman sort of taxi driver, wisdom of the year award, I think. Anyway. But what they said was they didn't actually express any hostility to immigrants. Now, maybe they were making it nice for the American, but they didn't really seem that concerned. They were making fun of me about Trump quite a lot. Because of course, it was the summer of 2016. But what they were saying was just that they wanted control and that they wanted to know who they could trust. And, you know, after Brexit happened, I saw all of these people saying, things like, don't you understand that now I can't just leave Britain and go get an awesome job abroad? Now I can't just go like make all of my friends from other countries. Now I can't. I was like, yes, they totally understand that. That's why they didn't want you to do it, right? Is that people who have capital in a place, people who have capital in a social, like a very specific social milieu, they resent people who leave, right? I mean, because those people are actually depleting their capital. And that is the inherent tension of, you know, what Scruton is in favor of is that it does require you to have specific loyalties and to have specific, I think, too, of a really striking contrast for me. I worked in a construction office. I worked at Ground Zero, actually, on the disaster recovery site. And I was in a construction trailer, and there I am with my MBA. And I am, I think, the only person in the construction trailer with an MBA. Not that there's tons of people with like masters in civil engineering and quite smart people, but I am the only person who's participating in this particular weird kind of professional class, elite class that dominates journalism, for example. And a guy came in and he's talking about a fight he'd gotten into in Florida and how he was worried there might be charges because it had been quite a big brawl with him and a bunch of his friends and some other guys and their friends. And he said, and the thing I felt worst about, because his friend had, he said, my friend started it and he was wrong. And I very sort of innocently looked up and I said, well, I don't understand then. Why did you dive in? And everyone else in the trailer just looks at me like I have just grown another head. Right? Yeah. And they were like, because they're your friends, right? Right. And like that kind of morality seems very foreign and alien to the kind of educated mindset I don't think it actually is. I think that what we nominally profess is not the same as how we act. So if you see how people in fact act in like pylons about people who have maybe gotten something wrong or done something wrong in journalism, it looks very like this. But that said, we don't say that part out loud. You're never supposed to say that part out loud, right? And I think that at the end, though, the power of that is that you know who has your back, right? You know who you can trust in a way that it is harder to know when people refuse to profess this incredibly particularist, like, these are my mates. Mark Halperin, who dodged the draft, actually wrote a very beautiful column about this, beautiful essay about this, where he says, I dodged the draft and I was wrong. About Vietnam. And he says, you know, he found himself, he joined the Merchant Marine afterwards.
Yeah.
He finds himself on the prow of a ship with a British merchant seaman. And the guy like says, well, why aren't you in Vietnam? And he sort of starts explaining it's the wrong war, whatever. And the guy just looks at him and says, but those are your mates. Mm-hmm. Right. Is that kind of very elemental? That is the elemental kind of logic of the somewheres. And I actually think it's much more profoundly more powerful and actually more important and necessary to human flourishing than the anywheres want to admit.
Yeah. That's great. Great point. Great stories. Just a couple of footnotes. I think it's pronounced Don Quixote for sure, but I always say quixotic, but that's just a foot. That's a,
I could be wrong. It's one of those words that I've never heard pronounced. Yep, I only say it in my head. Yeah.
Purist listeners weigh in on this. And Mark Halperin is the novelist who's been a guest on Econ Talk. He is my favorite living novelist, and I'm a huge fan of his short stories as well, and just want to put that plug in. But the example you give, you know, Scruton has a really nice distinction between he says, in contrast with the tribal and religious, it is in contrast with the tribal and religious forms of membership that the nation should be understood. By a nation, I mean a people settled in a certain territory who share language, institutions, customs, and a sense of history, and who regard themselves as equally committed both to their place of residence and to the legal and political processes that govern it. And he's making a contrast. He says, you know, the tribe, you have a family that you then share your tribal connection with. In a religion, you share things with the faithful. The nation, you share things with your neighbors. And that's the level of intimacy. Sometimes it's a near stranger or an actual stranger, but they're your mates in a certain sense that you're that Mark Halperin's conversation was about. So I think it's a I agree with you. It's not something that certain people like to talk about, but I think it's deep within us. All those connections, I think they're all important and not always consciously understood. The other thing he talks a lot about that I wanted to talk about with you is this idea of accountability. So I don't think it's so much that you don't want people to leave and take their social capital with them. The way Scruton emphasizes in the book, and he says this many different ways, and I found it quite eloquent, is that, I mean, he really gives a beautiful defense of democracy, of not really democracy, but what's called representative government, that the people who have power over you are accountable to you at the ballot box. And what bothered him, and I think I'm sure there are many reasons people voted to leave the European Union for Brexit, but what bothered many people was the idea that the people who can tell us what to do are not our neighbors, and I can't, they're not accountable to me or my neighbors, and yet they have sovereignty over us. And so this idea of sovereignty, I thought was quite eloquent, even though listeners will know I am not I don't have a religious view of representative democracy. I think it's deeply flawed. Scruton kind of ignores many of the flaws, but he understands there's something precious about it. And what is literally precious, it's not so much that, oh, it leads to great decisions, because it often doesn't. It's not so much that it isn't prone to rent-seeking, because it is, but rather it creates a feeling among us, those of us who live within a border, that we are part of a shared enterprise, and the powers that be are limited, to some extent at least, by our work at the ballot box. And I thought I thought that's important. And I don't know, yeah, he's romanticized a little bit too much for my taste, but he says it very well.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think there's a lot of political theorists who talk about this, about the fact that, like, you know, democratic representation always fails, but nonetheless, kind of democracy manufactures this really important thing called democratic legitimacy, right? Which is just this feeling that the state is legitimate in what it does. And that's in many ways an easier thing to maintain than, say, the divine right of kings. But, you know, yeah, I think he is romantic on a bunch of levels, right? I mean, someone descended from Northern Ireland, I sort of, when he got to his description of the famine, I was like, well, it was kind of mismanaged. It was like, well, that's one way to put it. You know, there's like half of the island died. You might pause a little bit longer there and meditate on the British Empire.
Let me interrupt, Megan, because let me quote from the book, and you can tie in your point to that, because I thought this was very relevant for the United States. This is what he said about England. He says, "We live with two rival conceptions of our past standing to either side of the central icon, like warring heraldic beasts. On one side, there is the proud people who defended their sceptered isle for a millennium, during the last centuries of which, in a burst of self-confidence, they carried trade, self-government, and law around the world. On the other side, there's the race of grasping imperialists who spread chaos abroad and conflict at home in pursuit of world domination." And I think, you know, I think the United States is going through a similar problem, challenge, that our conception of who we are as a nation is a half full and half empty, or at best half full, half empty, that there's this proud part of us, and then there's this ashamed part. And many people have decided to only choose one. I don't know why it's so hard not to understand that it's a mixed bag and we're trying to do better, but that view is totally off the table for most people. So your point about Northern Ireland is like, excuse me, what about that other beast on the other side? And you're right, of course. And he admits he's more attracted to one side than the other. Sorry, go ahead.
But I think I'm actually sympathetic in some ways to him, despite the fact that my own familial myth making is on the other side of, right, this is, they're just rapacious bastards, the English. Although I mean, like, my mother is half English and in descent. I'm only really three quarters Irish. One of the big questions I have is whether, quite apart from the claims about morality and accuracy and all the rest of it, right? Is there something that is for a nation fundamentally unhealthy about not you? I think it is unhealthy if a nation is unwilling to admit the bad things that it has done, right? I think that is a fundamentally unhealthy thing. But is there something really disturbing about the sight of a nation that has decided to only focus on the bad things it did, where the professional historians are more and more interested in a narrative of America that, it seems to me, I'm going to be criticized, this is reductive. I'm aware this is reductive, but I think that there is a real truth. There is a true thread here that I'm pulling on, of kind of where the only good thing America ever did was to suck slightly less than it had before. And that you can sort of tell history as Americans just being really horrible, but then every so often they're pushed into being slightly less horrible by the few good people dotted here and there, right? And I think that, quite apart from whether that's accurate, and I would contest that it is, you have to ask, can a nation survive with that as its core self-conception? Can a nation survive if most of what you are teaching children is bad things about the country simply because, or slightly, you know, slightly becoming slightly less bad, and that's all you ever teach the kids? Because I think nations do at some level need to have some self-esteem. And if they don't, the nation doesn't hold together. You know, right or wrong, you have to have something that people admire. In the same way that a healthy individual has to have things that it admires about itself, which aren't just, well, you know, you used to be much worse. and now you aren't quite so bad. I think a healthy nation, to hold itself together, to claim, make claims on each other, has to have a fundamental idea of actually, like, overall, we're pretty good. And I think that implicates a lot of things. You know, a welfare state is a fundamentally nationalist project. You can argue, you know, we're not debating whether we should extend universal healthcare to people in Chad. Maybe we should, but we're not. We are debating the contours of what we owe to our American neighbors. And within that context, if America itself is terrible, why would I owe anything to them? Why would I view myself as a participant in this exalted thing that can cause me, can place claims on me up to and including my life?
Well, that's the best argument against national healthcare I've ever heard, but that's just kidding. But I know that's not what you meant. I think it's actually what you said, all joking aside, it's quite important and quite serious. I do think, you know, I've been alluding to this now for a few years, that I'm worried about a civil war in America. When you have a large segment of the population that thinks the country is irredeemable, cannot be redeemed, it is hopelessly evil, and you have another group that thinks it's done a lot of great things, and maybe could be better, but has done a lot of great things. Those two sides tend not to get along. They were not going to get along in political compromise. They're not going to get along if there's ever a national threat that they need to pull together to fight. If they do, it won't work quite as well. So I think it's an extremely important issue, and I think it rips through education in an incredibly important way. You know, Scruton complains in the book, I don't know if it's fair, but he complains that the left, the pessimists, the England is a rapacious group of imperialists who sought world domination, has dominated education. And certainly in the United States, increasingly young people are taught that America is a horrible place. I would suggest that those are people who haven't been to other horrible places, for sure, and or haven't read enough history. But I think it's putting that, as you also did, putting aside whether how accurate or inaccurate any one version of this is, I think the question of what it bodes for the country is what's important. Now, you could argue, as many libertarians do, and we're both have a libertarian streak and have lots of friends who have more than a streak, you could argue, well, who cares? None of that matters. I mean, you know, if America had to go, you know, do some big national project, which shouldn't, said the libertarians, then it would come into play. But what's the big deal? What's the difference if you and your neighbor have different conceptions of American history, say? One of you thinks it's about 1619, the other thinks it's about 1620. Who cares? All that is just emotional baggage. It's, you know, it's part of your identity, perhaps. But why does it matter, you know, as a country? There is no we, as I've often argued on here. That's not relevant, says the libertarian. What's your response? Do you have a reaction to that?
I mean, look, I think that, look, I am a libertarian, but I've always been a very smart libertarian who I will not identify because I don't think I was authorized to pass this quote on. But recently, and in the last few years, said to me, you know, libertarianism is just a species of American nationalism. Hmm. And I think that more and more there is an element of truth to that, that it's a quite, when you meet libertarians abroad, they're different, right? They'll be like, well, I'm a libertarian, but of course I don't want to get rid of national healthcare. I don't want to do, right? It is actually, to go back to Scruton, it's quite rooted in our national history. It's quite rooted in the American Constitution. It is quite rooted in the Declaration of Independence and how we can save the American Revolution. Libertarianism. Yeah. And it is itself a contingent set of developments, which is, I think, why, while I am worried about the fact that it's not a good moment for libertarians in politics, right? I think after 2016, I went to a dinner with a bunch of libertarian lawyers, which may or may not have ended with me pounding the table and shouting, "We lost. We are the ones who lost this election." But
prescient.
The thing that I think, this was right after, this is November 9th or something. I think too that libertarianism spoke to a lot of problems America had in 1980 and 1990, and it speaks less to the problems that people perceive right now. And I think that eventually it will speak more to them again. So I'm less worried about the demise of purist libertarianism. For me, it's more of a tendency than a, you know, kind of the Adam Smith man of system with all the interlocking levers. But because of that, I've always known that I was American. I've always loved the American flag and all of the patriotic stuff. I like singing the national anthem at sporting events. And I think it's madness when people suggest that the way to deal with the national anthem protests, which, by the way, I am in sympathy with, is to not sing the national anthem. In fact, I think America needs more empty displays of patriotism, because those are the things that we need, the things that bind us. We need the things that we can all participate in. And if there is, or I guess I would have said before the national anthem protests, if there is one thing that is, you know, empty of content, can we all be glad that we won at least one battle during the War of 1812, right? I mean, no one cares about, even the British don't care anymore. They burned the White House. They left. They're not even mad about it. So can we just celebrate this, right? And that I think you do need those things. And I want to emphasize that I'm not suggesting that we should not teach the horrific legacy of slavery and genocide in schools. We should. And we should teach people that it was horrific. And we should also teach people that it is tragically bound up in many of the things, certainly, that the history of the 50s would have celebrated, right? That we now find hard to celebrate for various reasons, the westward expansion and all the rest of it, that those were made possible partly because our diseases, and I think, I don't actually blame us for this. We couldn't have known. And I don't think there's anything wrong with coming here to trade with the Native Americans if you don't realize you're about to give them European plagues that will just decimate them. I can't morally blame people for that part of the expansion, the post-Columbian expansion. But we did. The Columbian expansion brought European diseases here and caused a mass die-off of the people who had been here. And we should acknowledge that everything we have, not in a stupid land acknowledgement way, I think it's almost borderline offensive, right? I'm doing this on the land that I took from Native Americans. Yeah. I just want everyone to know that.
Right? Yeah. Well, a lot of people announce that now. It's a thing.
It's such a weird way of doing things. And this is the ultimate empty gesture, right? And I think if you're going to make empty gestures, they should be positive, not negative.
Interesting.
But, you know, so I don't want to not acknowledge that whole history and have people understand that, you know, many things, but I also am against trying to frame every single thing that happened through this. I mean, there's recently a report, the Tenement Museum in New York, which is built on the Lower East Side, and the conceit of the museum is that each apartment represents a family who lived there during its tenement history. And it represents the people who lived in the neighborhood, Irish and Italian and so forth. The Spectator just reported that they're going to get rid of the Irish apartment so that they can have an African-American family, which on the one hand is like a laudable effort at representation, but on the other hand, the Lower East Side never was an African-American neighborhood. And what did the Irish do to deserve being turfed out, right? I think that...
Are the Jews there, Megan? That's what I want to know.
There's a Jewish family.
Oh, phew. Okay. Obviously.
It's the Lower East Side, Russ.
But you got pushed. Your group got pushed out. It could have been ours. Yeah. I don't know why we got the long straw and you got the short straw. I want to talk. That's fascinating. But I want to talk about the ties that bind us, and I'll come back to your libertarian roots and your Irish roots. So I'll come back to my Jewish roots and my libertarian roots as well. There are a lot of ties that bind us, right? Many of which we choose. Now you can choose where to live in some extent. You don't can't choose where you're born. So you were born, I think, in America. I was born in America, but. As I grew up, a lot of the time, and I grew up like you, I had a very patriotic feeling in many times in my life. As I got older, other ties bound me more closely. My religious ties, say, to my synagogue and my local Jewish community. It could be my ties to my colleagues at work in my economics department, and we were trying to achieve certain things. And I think what's interesting is there is a place where these things they connect, and it's in the Burkean, it's Edmund Burke, the small platoons that Burke talked about, and the civil society that de Tocqueville wrote about when he came to the United States. So in both, and I found this fascinating because Scruton was writing about England, but he could have been writing about the United States. He talks about all the voluntary associations we have. They could be religious. They're often hobbies. They're sports. There's a lot of that in America. There's a lot of it in England. And I think libertarians often say that's what counts, not the national ones. But I think what Scruton's point is, and I think this is quite challenging to most of my worldview, and I take it seriously, and I found it thought-provoking, is that there is this national thing that allows that. And it's not just the laws. It's the inherent culture of trust that gets created. It's the inherent associations we have with each other rooted in place, in physical place, not just some abstract thing. And that borders matter more than we like to admit.
I think that that's right. I mean, I think too, there's nothing to make you feel like an American, like living abroad, right? Is suddenly you realize all of the ways in which you are very much not like the people elsewhere. And there is, for me at least, I loved living abroad and I love traveling abroad. But there's always this moment for me when I get into the airport. And yeah, it's big and American. It's filled with, you know, fat people. And they're not all that well-dressed. And you look around and you're like, everyone here ate the same breakfast cereal I did when I was a kid. It's just all of these small things, right? But they matter. They matter a lot in the end. And I think that that is the thing that the pandemic drove home, but I'd always already thought, right? Is that at the end of the day, now libertarians have lots of reasons to be mad at the government and so forth. But libertarians should also note that the reason they have vaccines is that the US government made sure it happened. And the reason that they don't have to worry about other people being vaccinated is that the U.S. government guaranteed that anyone could get a free vaccine if they wanted it, right?
I'm not sure I agree with that, Megan. I'm going to have to push back on that just for a second.
Okay,
I think in a world where the government was less involved, we might have gotten the vaccine a lot sooner. It might have had a lot of side effects and killed a bunch of us. I accept that possibility. But the FDA dragged its feet on testing, dragged its feet on lots of things. So I take the
okay,
point
let me,
that
let me,
governments...
Let me,
yeah.
I think there are two things going on here, right? One is that, yes, our institutions, our public health institutions failed radically in a bad way, right? Okay, so we've talked about this in other podcasts, in other Econ Talk. But the U.S. government did one really, really good thing, which was Operation Warp Seed, which is it said to everyone, look, just build a bunch of factories and manufacture it. We'll make sure you don't lose money.
Yeah, no, that was really, it could have happened privately really, in different worlds in different ways, but that worked out well.
Yeah.
I agree with
you. But also the price guarantees that like everyone gets it, even if they, you know, they don't, and if the vaccine cost any amount of money, right, there would be a lot of people who'd be like, oh, I'm not paying $15 to get a, right?
Yeah.
That part of it actually worked really well. And I think that this is a kind of, there are collective action problems here that the U.S. government could actually handle. Now, didn't necessarily, but certainly could. But also just more broadly, that even if the U.S. government had done none of this, all of the other governments were going to act like they were governments and they were going to close their borders. And so the U.S. like couldn't make itself better off by being the only one that just didn't have a government that reacted. And in fact, we put a lot of money into a lot of stuff that I think did make the pandemic better. You can certainly imagine that absent a government coordinating role, the early wave could have been worse, just because there are a lot of critiques of lockdown that I buy. I think the kind of very initial one was not enough, but worked better,
Megan,
than people give credit for.
If I was going to give you a really hard time, I'd point out that China had a much stiffer lockdown, did much better. But let's put that.
Yeah.
I want to stay away. Let's stay away from the pandemic. I want to give you a harder question.
Okay.
I want to riff on your point about coming back to your American airport, and I'm in Israel. I lived in America for 67 years and loved many of those minutes, not all of them, but many of them. It's a very proud American. Still, I'm an American citizen. Still, pretty proud, I'd say. But I'm now an Israeli. I've got Israeli citizenship. And I have a connection to Israel that's different than Bulgaria because I'm Jewish. You are Irish. Now, it's true that if you spent a winter in Bulgaria, you might be really glad to come home to people who had the same breakfast cereal as you did as a child. But I'm curious, because I know you've written about it, and I'm curious for you to talk about what's meaningful to you about Ireland, which surprised you, I think, when you first went back there. Because you're not, I mean, your name's Irish, really. I mean, really, come on. But you felt more than that. So talk
I
about
also
that.
Look really Irish. So I look basically like the feminine version of my dad. And that family's genes are amazing. They all look like he and his sisters, they all look, bear this incredibly strong family resemblance, which I inherited. And so I had a really weird experience of going back there. I went to cover Brexit subsequent to the vote. I mean, this is when it was actually going to happen, and then it didn't happen. But this was in the spring of 2018. And I just started working for the Post. And I go to Britain, and nothing happens. So now I'm stuck there for 2 weeks, and I don't know what to do. So I was like, okay, I think I'm going to go write about the Irish language in the Gaelic-speaking areas, Irish-speaking areas of the West Coast. And I end up in, for various reasons, mostly because I already had a plane ticket to Belfast, where I was supposed to be to cover Brexit, I ended up in Donegal, which has the smallest of the Irish-speaking areas. And but this also happens to be near where my family's from. So my family's from Armagh, which is known as Bandit Country. And it's on the border of the north. It really should have joined the Republic, but the vote was kind of rigged. This is the county that least belonged in Northern Ireland when the vote happened after Irish independence. And so I go to the town I'm from, which was its own little adventure, because people were like, oh yeah, the McCardles are up on that hill. You should go see them. I was like, my family left during the famine. I don't think anyone's going to remember us. But then I drive up to Donegal, and I have these wonderful people at the Irish agency that promotes the Irish language, because this is, I mean, the Irish is a somewhat similar situation to Hebrew in that, different, because Hebrew had, first of all, they had a really strong founder effect, as there's just a few people living there and they all decide they're going to speak Hebrew. And they managed to then kind of inculcate that in all the newcomers. Ireland went the other way, which is that it was a majority Irish-speaking country until the famine, which disproportionately killed the poorer people who lived in the west of Ireland, where the language was more dominant. And so because it had absentee landlords and also the land tended to be poorer. And so it's just hanging along on this fringe on the coast now, but there's a really, really strong effort to revive it, which is ironically getting a boost from immigration, apparently. I was told when I was in Dublin that parents who don't want their kids in school with, say, Polish immigrants' kids are now putting their kids in the Irish-only schools just because they know the only people there will be Irish.
Not surprised. Okay. Get back to your travel.
I'm back there, and they're telling me, so the first thing the guy I meet at this agency tells me is, oh, the McCardles. Yeah, so they're a sept of the O'Neill family, and they're kind of, they're like a little bit raffish. And I was like, raffish? And he said, do you know the term border reaver? And so he's telling me, just reeling stuff off about my McCardle ancestors. And then what I realized was, in just a weird way, I look like people there.
Oh, yeah.
So I was on a street and someone came up and asked me for directions, and I was dressed like an American, but I just look like everyone else there. This has never happened to me. I grew up in New York, where I don't look like most of the people who live there. And it was a really uncanny. And I'm in the office where they're promoting the Irish, and they're all native Irish speakers. And so they're holding meetings in Irish. They're just randomly talking to each other in a way that, like, kids like me who took like one semester of Irish at the behest of our parents, I can't really say anything. And I realized this is what I would have looked like. This is who the people I would have been around. This is the language I would have spoken if not for the intervention of a lot of history. And I felt a little cheated. I felt sad that I didn't speak the language. I felt sad that I didn't know, because they know the landscape. So, like, all the rocks have names, all the rivers have names. And I missed that. And at the end of the trip, I said to the guy, I'm definitely going to come back. And he said, you have to, this is your home. And I thought, but no, it isn't, right? At the end of the day. But I was sad to miss, and I think this is something that Scruton is talking about, and something that an American actually, I think Jewish Americans who it's Aliyah is to Israel, is that the right word?
Aliyah.
You make Aliyah, right? There's something similar there, but that Americans in general don't have that feeling, and we miss it.
Correct.
We miss that feeling of this, like, the gene pool, basically in Northern Ireland, except for the influx of Brits, like that whole gene pool is basically undisturbed since the Paleolithic and the Neolithic, really. But I mean, for thousands of years. And it was just an odd, uncanny feeling to suddenly find myself in the middle of the gene pool that I was drawn out of. Yeah. And that thing, it's incredibly powerful. And it is actually like, I was sad to not have it. And at the end of the day, though, I don't, because I'm American. Yeah. And that's a totally different kind of identity. Very place-based, yeah. Very culture-based, but different. And I think that really stuck with me. And I think that is something with Judaism as well, right? Is that this is a people who has maintained themselves for thousands of years, despite having their home destroyed by the Romans and the people scattered deliberately after, you know, following the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and to have maintained that blood connection, but also this deep creedal connection to a book and a way. And I actually think that the danger of Scruton, there's a quote that really struck me, which I will now try to read schoolteacher fashion to the class so that I don't miss the mic. but he says, "We who are the heirs to the labor of people such as Goethe, Mendelssohn, Wordsworth, Chateaubriand, and so forth, often fail to appreciate their achievement, which was to transform religion into culture and a hope of eternity into a vision of coexistence in the here and now." And I was really struck by that. And I also wonder if that isn't just so specifically British. Right.
Well, it could
so
be.
Specifically, but I wondered what you thought of that specifically, because I believe you observe the Sabbath.
Yep.
And you are in a country that is kind of founded on something very different from that.
Yeah. Well, I thought what he had to say about religion and how it, he's very, I don't know if he was a religious man or not, but he talks about, he certainly had some religious feeling. I've read some of his other books, but not an expert on Roger Scruton in any way. But he argues, perhaps not correctly, but interestingly, that there's a residue of Christianity in the British people, of a sense of trust, a sense of neighborliness, kindness, a desire to be a better person. I don't know if that's true, fair, who knows? I'm not interested in that, but I think that is part of the British character to some extent. It's part of the American character. It's not part of every character, for sure, every national character. There are different kinds. But to come back to your question about Judaism and here, you talked about, I had a very similar experience here. It was very early when I got here. We've been here now 5 months, and we're going to have an episode coming up soon where I talk about the move and what it's like to be an immigrant. And it's been a very incredibly interesting experience. But early on in my time here in Jerusalem, I ran into someone who I don't know well. I'd met him once 5 years ago in some setting. And he said, "Oh, good. You made Aliyah." He said, "Welcome home." And, you talked about Judaism being and I've always hated that, by the way, that welcome home thing. Like the idea that I don't belong in America, I really belong in Israel, is sort of the implication of that. And I'm not going to talk about that, but you talk about, Judaism being about a people and a book. It is also about a land. And to tour here, to travel here to the North Sea, to the Golan, and to go to the town of Gamla, which the Romans destroyed about 2,000 years ago, and find a synagogue is sobering. It pulls you up short. You don't expect it. The Jews have been here for 2,000 plus years, more like 3,000 plus years, is unlike anything, as you say, that I'm used to experiencing as an American. My American family came to America in the late 19th century, early 20th century, like most Jewish families did. But I always felt American, because that's what's beautiful about America, or at least has been. I think that's up for grabs now, and I think that's a tragedy. But the idea was, you weren't a Jewish American, you were an American. You weren't an Italian American, an Irish American. You might have a heritage you were proud of, but that heritage was a heritage. It's not your identity. You subsume that identity. And that may not, it's an ideal, it's a vision. And what you're suggesting is that it comes at something of a, maybe of a cost, or it's more complicated than that. And by the way, we had Michael Brandon Doherty talk about this from an Irish perspective. It's a lovely episode. You can find the archive. We'll put a link up to it. But I think this question of home, of, and I'm going to make it a little different than the home. I think it's really about belonging. And to really go back to the challenges I think America and other countries are facing now, it's a problem if you don't feel you belong. And I think, obviously, if you're Black or other minority or oppressed group of the past and maybe of the present, maybe different amount, but doesn't matter, you can't belong. And or you can't belong in the same way. As an immigrant, can you belong in the same way you want to? I mean, I think that's clearly part of the American dream. It's not about owning a house. It's about becoming part of the same team. It's about being part of the same group. It's about rowing together in the same direction. Now, again, might not be rowing anywhere, and that's kind of maybe kind of silly, but I think in 2021, national identity has become a phenomenon, whether one likes it or not. People care about it. You might argue they shouldn't, but they do care about it. And it's a part of who we are, which is, you know, the name of the Screwed book is Where We Are, but it's a part of who we are. And I think, you know, you talked about libertarianism losing the election in 2016. Most of the libertarian counterpoints and counterarguments to these kind of concerns are irrelevant. People don't feel that way, the way the libertarians claim they do or should. It's just not, it's not on the table. And I think that's, I'd say the same thing about economics, by the way. I think economics as a contributor to public policy has been incredibly subsumed in the national debate. It was front and center for decades, starting in the 70s, really, you could argue. And now it's like, who cares? We'll care again. Trust me.
We'll care again.
We will care again. And
economics has a way of making you care.
Yeah,
if you saw
it. It's exactly. But right now, it doesn't have that salience that identity has for most people or belonging. And I just think, anyway, that.
And I think there's a couple of things that are worth noting about that. And I think the first thing is that identity becomes more important when you're not getting constantly richer. Right? Is that.
Yeah.
It is that identity is what you is your insurance if you don't have financial insurance. And so the more you feel like maybe the future is just not infinitely getting better, probably the more you need identity. But I also think there's something that you talked about how, you know, Blacks or immigrants or that they feel excluded from the national identity, right? And I think that that's obviously true. And I think we are trying to rectify that, which is good.
Yeah, for sure.
But I also think there's another thing, because I'm going to speak carefully here because obviously I don't want to kind of just, but you know, my dad comes out of this. My mother's family, her mother's family has been here since before the revolution. And, you know, she was a daughter of the American Revolution, not the weird, creepy, racist part, the part where like it's just old ladies sit around like trading little like Betsy Ross samplers and stuff. This is the Northern DAR, not the one that wouldn't let a Black woman perform in the DAR hall down here. And so then there's my dad's family, which moved to Charlestown in Boston, basically stayed there forever. My grandfather had a business there, but the family, his parents moved to West Roxbury, which is a suburb. He went to Roxbury Latin, which is a fairly fancy private school. And
it's outside of Boston.
It's outside of Boston, yeah. Sorry, I should have made that clear. Right. So, but Charlestown, the place that he left and that a lot of the middle class Irish families left, was also the place that had one of the worst busing riots. And it went on for a year. There's a great book about it.
Riots about the busing of Black students
of
into
black
their neighborhood
during integration in the 70s. And it becomes a whole controversy. I won't get into that here. It's too much. But one thing that I see in that side of my family, and you know, like all my father's sisters, they all got advanced degrees and so forth. But what I see is that, you know, they were pulled out of a very ethnically specific milieu that offered something, but was also created by discrimination. It was created by the fact that in Boston, the Protestants didn't want the Catholics hanging around, right? And it was created by these ethnic enclaves also, like, for them, they're really salient prior to the busing. You know, when my dad's growing up in the 50s and 60s, the really salient fights are between the Irish and the Italian kids. Race doesn't even really enter into it. It's a very ethnic place. And what I sense in my generation is this sadness at losing that, is that for us, it was a much less salient identity because no one cared. You know, I've encountered two instances of anti-Catholic bigotry in my life, and they both struck me as funny because, you know, like, I had a woman at a hotel. I worked at one of those Catskills hotels from Dirty Dancing, and a woman just kept calling me the name of her Irish maid from like the 20s. And someone finally said, I don't think that's her name. And she was like, oh, we always change the name of our Irish maids. The Irish don't care about things like that. Right. And to me, that's funny because, yeah, of course, we don't care about names. Like,
yeah, of course.
Right. Those things were funny to me. They weren't funny to my dad's generation because they were real. And so but that thing, that losing the discrimination, which was good and which enabled my father and his sisters to go out into the world and be successful, also meant losing this quite particularist attachment to a very specific community. And I think that for immigrants and for successful Black people and for other people, there is this feeling of, like, because they are still in a place, in this liminal place where the identity is more salient than being Irish American is in 2020, right? There is this sense of having to negotiate that, of not just becoming more recognized as an American by the American community as should happen, but that as that happens, as the prejudice and the discrimination lessen, it also actually lessens ties that bind your identity. They are created, and I think this is something that Scruton goes into a lot, which is that those ties are created by not being able to leave them. Right, that at the, you know, that we like the idea of this kind of the social contract of the chosen community of but that actually, you know, he talks about family. He talks about, you know, that there's one quote where he basically talks about that these ties enable us to choose, as these ties to family and so forth. And I think that that's not right, actually. I think that they kind of precondition our choosing, right? That we have to have those ties to family. If you don't have unchosen obligations that you can't shed, you're in some way not fully participating in the human condition. And that that beautiful, deep communities are created by horrible exclusion. Right, is that, you know, that those things, the exclusion is bad and should end. I'm not defending in any way the exclusion. I'm saying that there's a kind of completely unintended byproduct, which is that you have this precious thing. You have this group of people who are like you, and it's smaller and it's intimate, and you have all of the things that you love about it. For the Irish, the music, it's not the food, but it's
the drink.
There's the drinking, although my family's actually
quite
temperance.
No, not the drinking, just the drink. Just the drink. Yeah, just the Irish whiskey is a lovely thing.
But there's the dancing, there is the language, it's everything. And to have people scatter and go into wider America and not recognize each other. I mean, like, my husband thinks it's really funny that both Tim Carney, who's a journalist at the Washington Examiner, we were like, oh yeah, no, they're Irish, they're Italian, right? To slowly lose that is to lose something important. And I think that you sense in a lot of the ambivalence that elites have, that I don't want to let go of that. I want to have that and this. And I actually think that to some extent, I see that in my father. I see that in, I think it's not possible to have that and this. I think it's actually, you have one or the other, and the more you have one, the less you have of the other. And I think that's something that people are really struggling with.
Yeah, I think that's
in
true.
America right now.
I think that's true. My parents grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, which they experienced much more anti-Semitism. I've experienced very little, and certainly America in 2021 has more frightening things about it for Jews than it had when I was younger, but it's still a pretty pleasant place to be Jewish, America is. But my parents would never, if you asked my parents whether anti-Semitism was a big part of their life, they would say, of course not. Now, it turned out intermarriage wasn't an issue in 1950s Memphis because nobody wanted to marry a Jew. It wasn't like a religious principle to stay married to a Jewish person, to marry a Jewish person. It just, the Jews kept to themselves. It was a very insular, tight-knit community. And to this day, my mom, you know, who's 89, she knows anyone in Memphis over the age of 80 who grew up in Memphis. They all knew each other. And that was, as we've talked many times on this program, there's wonderful things about it, not so wonderful things. It's a mixed bag, but it's certainly a piece of your identity that you lose when the world becomes friendlier to your ethnic group or your religion. And it's just, like you said, I think we have a limited capacity to connect in that way, and we connect the way we can. If we're not getting one, we look for another. If we're not getting it somewhere, we look for it somewhere else. And we look for places. It's kind of a simpler point I should make, which is we look for ways to belong. And sometimes it comes through our religion. It might come through our race. It might come through our ethnic group. It might come through our hobbies. It might come through our passions. And belonging matters to people. I have to say that, read this one quote, though, because I'm going to shift gears unless you want to say something else.
No. Well, I was going to say this, is that I think that probably one of the reasons that economics seems less salient and identity more is that those littler forms of identity are attenuating, right? Religion is declining. Television and everything has been nationalized to an extent that people aren't participating in the same way as they used to, where there would be like local newspapers that you were reading that were geared towards the people who were your immediate neighbors. That as that stuff attenuates, people are more and more desperate for some identity. And I think that what we have seen is that, you know, half of the country is kind of looking towards these particularist identities as smaller subgroups of America. The identity politics, you can call it. But then there you have the conservatives who are kind of desperately trying to reconstruct this big national identity, kind of World War II style identity, mm-hmm. because the smaller stuff is missing. And I think that that is a problem. I don't know how to solve the problem, but it's a problem.
That's a great observation. I think we're in the middle of a great time of turmoil. You know, the loss of religion as a form of belonging and as a sense of identity is definitely in decline. It's to decline all over the Western world and has been for a long time, but especially in the United States over the last 25 years. It's a much more dramatic, steeper decline, especially among young people. And that's going to change things. And I wouldn't begin to predict how that might change things. But people certainly look, you know, I like to quote David Foster Wallace, everyone worships. Just a question of what. And if you're not going to worship the divine, you'll find something else to worship if you're a human being. That's his claim. I find it a fascinating claim. We'll see how that proceeds going forward. I just wanted to quote, there's a couple quotes I want to get from the book, the Scruton book, that I don't want to miss because they're so good. I've confessed on the show before that I really like The Crown, and I found that the soap opera on Netflix, and I confess to it because I have zero interest in the British monarchy. I don't keep up. It's never been my thing, not my thing, still isn't my thing. And I was impressed with how much I was drawn into that show, and Scruton gave me an idea of why, and I thought that might be fun to just read and get your reaction. He says, in the eyes of the people, the assertion of national identity and togetherness remains the principal duty of the crown, and their willing undertaking of this duty is the reason the queen and the royal family remain so firmly anchored in the people's affections. Now, what's fascinating about that, end of quote, what's fascinating about that quote to me, first of all, it explains to me some of the reason why the crown, meaning the British monarchy, the queen, the royal family, they're not just some weird show. They actually have a role to play. It's not a role that we think of as a monarchy, as Americans. It has a different role. And that show gets at it. It gets at the role, certainly gets at the role of duty. But I was just struck by how insightful that is. And the idea that people still like the queen in England, of course, many don't. And I suspect many of them are the anywheres. The somewheres are big on the queen and the royal family. And that's why they matter, because they are the essence of somewhere. Can't get more somewhere than Buckingham Palace and the royal family. And it's just, I thought that was a really important insight.
You can't outsource it. Outsource it to China.
they used to a little bit.
Right.
They used to import their kings and queens, but once they're on the ground, they're British.
Once they're on the ground, they were expected to act like British people. And I think, I think that's right. Is that they're, and yet also I think you note, right. Is that in fact, these guys have ties to everywhere, which is why, hemophilia is so distributed throughout the royal families of Europe because they're all so interbred. And so I think that, that's actually an interesting point, is the ways in which the monarchy has both been a focal point for this affection and this somewhereness, but also has been a way of tying the somewheres through birth and through everything else to other places within Europe to build alliances that way. Very atavistic way to think about things, and yet I think still matters that these guys all like go to each other's weddings and so forth. Actually does matter a little bit, that it helps create this kind of European feeling that Scruton is ultimately kind of saying can't exist or at least doesn't exist right now. This feeling of Europe as a real place, as a somewhere that we all belong to. Maybe they need more royals, not less. More royal pomp.
They're dropping like flies. They're abdicating. They're leaving town. It's a hard job, as the show illustrates really quite eloquently. I want to take an issue now that Scruton raises that I have to confess makes me uncomfortable, but it's fascinating to me, and I think he's again makes the case quite well. At one point, he contrasts the London skyline with the Paris Parisian skyline. London skyline, he argues, is ugly. It's jagged. He compares it, I think, to a bunch of teeth. There's a bunch of modern buildings built by finance companies and on the Thames and else nearby that he evidently doesn't like. It certainly doesn't look like it looks. My favorite counterpoint to this would be, say, the London of Mary Poppins. You have a certain look and feel of what London should look like, and that's gone. Not totally, but a lot of it's been destroyed and replaced by other things. And as economists and often as libertarians, we say, and that's good. That's change is good. Dynamism is good. It's great. Contrast that with Paris. Paris has strict regulations about, not in all of the city, but in a good chunk of the city, strict regulations about building height and what buildings have to look like. And I think they have to get washed a certain number of times. things that we as economists often make fun of or criticize. As a result, though, there's a certain look and feel to it that is, I've often criticized as museum-like. But sometimes it's nice to be in a museum. If I were a Parisian, I might not feel that way. But it's an interesting question, and similarly gets a lot of mileage out of both the French and the British countryside, English countryside, that they have a certain look and feel, and there's an argument for preserving them. Now, I think most of the argument comes from rent-seeking farmers who want government money, but it's worth thinking about the fact that there are people who, for them, that's France or that's England or Scotland. It's just an interesting question of whether there's an argument to be made for a certain creation of a look and feel that would not emerge from a free market, multiple choices by free citizens, but rather by a more top-down approach. What are your thoughts on that?
I was really struck by his argument that in fact a lot of these restrictions create what he calls social capital, and he then argues that this is actually like economically friendly because it's creating all this social capital. I'm still grappling with it.
Creative. Very creative. A bit of a stretch for me, but I thought it was interesting.
I also think it was a bit of a stretch. I would also note something, though, is that the thing he hates about the London skyline, I was just actually reading that someone was saying that the parts of London that are bombed are much more productive than the parts that aren't, that weren't during World War II, because that was where people could build. It was where you get around the quite onerous British planning restrictions. But I would make another point, which is that the reason that Paris looks like it looks, and the reason London looks like it looks, it has so many new buildings kind of peppered in among the old, is that France surrendered to Germany and Britain didn't. And so France, Paris didn't get bombed in the submission, and Britain did. And so in some way, the very thing that he is objecting to was created by the placeness of Britain and the incredibly strong. There's also, like, it's harder to invade an island than France, but I think that France did give in and prevented its country from being destroyed, and Britain could have and didn't. I'm in favor of this, to be clear. That you have to sort of accept the good with the bad, which he sometimes doesn't do. He sort of skips back and forth. And I wish he had engaged with that, that the fact that they stood Fortress Britain for so long and endured the Blitz was the reason that all of the ugly buildings were built. Now, I think that Scruton, the architecture critic, would argue that we didn't have to build ugly buildings, which I agree with. But the fact that Britain changed was the fact that Britain didn't change in some sense.
That's a great observation. It's complicated.
Yes.
A lot of the buildings he objects to have been built long after the replacement of the aftermath of the Blitz, right, and the destruction.
But they're built in places in the same way that no one in New York City is like, we must. Actually, I'm sure there's some lunatic in New York City.
Yes, there are.
In general,
I don't know what you're going to say, but the answer is yes, there is.
Right, like, look at that glass box. Someone wants to build a slightly taller glass box. People may object on the grounds that it'll block their light or whatever, but they're not like, look at that gorgeous glass box. We must preserve it for eternity, right? You're getting some of this now around like the 50s and the brutalist buildings. But just the public itself just has much less attachment to it, those buildings, than it does to the pre-war co-ops that are all over the Upper West and Upper East Side. And there's a reason for that. I think it would have been a lot harder to build those tall buildings even much later had there been gorgeous old Victorian neighborhoods standing on those sites. And the fact that there wasn't was thanks to Hitler.
By the way, I was surprised that in Scruton's list of what was good about the British, you know, he mentions trade, law, and who cares what the third thing is. He did mention saving the world from the Nazis, but he mentions it in passing elsewhere, but that right, was the setting for some of these discussions. But I thought that was interesting. I think the other tension there, and I wish he were alive to defend himself, but the other tension is that, you know, he honors freedom a great deal in the book. And he talks about one of the things that makes England great is that it's free, meaning you're free to associate with who you want. You're free to join a club, free to join a religious group, free to, you could argue, maybe build a building. But he's happy to squash that freedom when he thinks it conflicts with another goal. And that's legitimate. He doesn't have to be a purist on that. But there is a tension there that he doesn't come to grips with. You know, he's basically arguing he's not anti-immigrant, but he says we should allow people into England who share our respect for English institutions, and how that would be done is a little easier. It's easier to write about it than to implement it. That's why it's, I think, an imperfect but useful book. It gets you to think about these things, even though it's probably more complicated. He would concede that, I'm sure, and it's a short book.
And I think that's the thing that America goes through, right? Is this tension of we are a nation of immigrants, but if the immigrants don't assimilate, is that a nation, right? And I think that this conflict can get overblown, because I think what you're seeing with Latino immigrants is they're super, like, they're more patriotic often than like progressives in the Democratic Party, right? Who've been here for generations and generations, is they think America's awesome. They love, like, they want the American dream. They want all of that. But, you know, how and when you demand assimilation, I think is important, because ultimately, there's an empirical question of, do people just assimilate because the dominant culture is there? I think often the answer is yes, and you don't really have to worry about over the long run. But I think there you could argue, I think a better argument for him to have made is that it is unhealthy to have a nation that is sufficiently unconfident in itself to say, you know, no, you are actually, there is a way of living here, and you do, if you want to live here, have to comply with that. And I think that the kind of anywhere idea of nations as hotels is fundamentally unworkable. You know, the idea is that there's just kind of this service provider and you pay to get the amenities you want and so forth. And that any redistributional impulse should be animated solely by this kind of universalist humanitarian goals. I just think that idea of a government and a place is actually a pretty unappealing idea to most people. And I think even unappealing to them, right? I mean, I often hear those things argued by the same people who complain that like everything, you probably noticed this traveling abroad, I've certainly noticed it, is that in the past 15, 20 years, everything's starting to look the same. So you walk into a bar in Italy and you could definitely be in that bar in Nashville or in Hong Kong or anywhere else. And it's not, obviously this is an exaggeration, but the proliferation of places like that, of like the coffee shops all look the same, not they're all Starbucks. They just all look the same. They all have the same potted plants sitting next to the same kind of Danish modern tables. And that erosion of place, people as travelers, you know, they're getting more and more freedom to travel and less reason to actually do so.
It's a fascinating point. People say it about America. You know, yeah, Atlanta looks a lot like Minneapolis. And 50 years ago, it didn't. It's a result of technology, trade, TV, the widespread social media, and crossing borders. Something fabulous about it, and there's something not so fabulous about it. As you point out, it's complicated. I want to encourage listeners, by the way, to go back and listen to Roya Hakakian's episode on coming to America as an immigrant, and also Lamorna Ash's episode on spending time with the Cornish family, which is very much a story of a something of an anywhere, definitely being somewhere on the Cornish coast on a cod fishing boat. In closing, does Scruton's book make you more or less optimistic about the future? Or is that not an issue you think about?
Oh, I think about that all the time.
Why?
Why do I think about it? Because, you know, I don't know that I'm worried about us having a civil war simply because my understanding from kind of people who study this is that civil wars are mostly about having too many young men wandering around, and we are an aging country. And also, we have pretty good state capacity to control, right? I think it's unlikely we're going to like lose control of parts of Texas or something. But I think that the thing that animates that, the sense that the anywheres have kind of already seceded from the country, in some fundamental way, and have formed their own little nation within a nation, I think is profoundly, and is now are now fighting kind of a rhetorical civil war with the rest of the country, I think is profoundly disturbing. And I think that, you know, it's not like the somewheres have reacted. And I think the way the somewheres have reacted to this is also profoundly, profoundly, profoundly disturbing. You know, the fact that we're arguing about whether you should let elections proceed according to the procedures that were laid out in the election law, because Donald Trump is too big of an egomaniac to admit he lost, is just, that's where we are. Of course I worry about the future. How could you not worry about the future right now? This is crazy stuff that I thought we all agreed on. Like, this is how elections happen.
Hey, Megan, I'm living in Israel. There's no worries here.
Well, right. Yeah. This is very
peaceful. I'm in a peaceful backwater in the Middle East. It's a piece of cake here. By the way, I just want to say, I'll let you close in a sec, but we've been talking about the somewheres and the anywheres for a good chunk of this hour, and it's David Goodhart is the author who coined that phrase. I want to give him credit. Scruton quotes David Goodhart and then uses that distinction. And it's one I think I'll remember for a long time. But carry on. I want to give you the last word.
Yeah, I worry about it. Because it's so particular, right? I think a lot of what he's saying is right. I think that the way forward for America too is to discover something in itself that can actually be celebrated outright and not merely celebrated as a being less bad than, which is the kind of victories that the left tends to celebrate. And then, you know, the right often does want this kind of mindlessly rah-rah history taught that doesn't mention all the really terrible things that, that the price that other people paid for us to have what we have. And which also excludes, you know, it is not nearly as inclusive as it could be of lots of groups that feel historically excluded for good reason. But having given those caveats, I think that Scruton is right that any way forward for any country is going to be rooted not on some set of abstract principles, but on visceral stuff. Because the problem with abstract principles at the end of the day is that people can argue themselves out of them as well as into them. Right. And that is fundamentally why this is your mates, why those things have to be part of a nation. And we really underestimate how hard it was to build nations. There's a great story from the Garibaldi coming to, I believe, Sicily. And, you know, his supporters are shouting, "Viva Garibaldi, viva l'Italia." And people thought his wife was named Talia because they didn't conceive of themselves. They didn't conceive of Italy as a thing. Right. That actually making Italy happen.
In the 1860s, presumably,
roughly. Making Italy happen, making Greece happen, making Germany happen, making, you know, we can debate the wisdom of that, but, you know, making those things happen was really difficult. And that building a nation, that it doesn't just happen. It's not something that you can count on, oh, the nation's going to be there, now we're just going to argue about the terms. Now we're just, no, actually, you're always in the process of creating a nation. And if you want to have a nation, and I submit that the left, as well as the right, does want to have a nation, and that the right should remember it wants to have that wanting to have a nation means wanting to have obligations, unchosen obligations to everyone in that nation, not just the people that you think are like you. And I think about this with something like Black Lives Matter, is that I've said to conservatives the whole way, like, okay, if you don't want to like that organization or that argument, then you should be out there when these abuses happen saying, this is America, these are Americans. We don't do that because this is America and these are Americans. That there is a way for the right to claim the same, make the same kinds of justice claims, but root them slightly differently within the kind of commonality, within the common nation, rather than making them a particularist claim against the nation, right? And that those things have to happen. And that everyone in the country is less interested in that common project. They're less interested in, like, what am I going to do to be building up the nation? And I think that if we are going to survive this as a healthy nation that is capable once again of moving forward together to do great things, then of course we're never going to, like, just all agree. And, you know, we're not going to have this rosy Scruton, I think, would also agree that his vision is a little bit rosy, right? Of we're all just, you know, this is always going to be a contentious process. We're always going to be fighting because have you been to Thanksgiving dinner? This is what families do too, right? This is what any unchosen particularist obligation means, is that you are going to have to have a lot of fights, and they're going to be really vicious because you can't get away. You can't just, you know, you don't fight, have vicious fights with the people at Starbucks, because at the end of the day, like, you can just take the business down the street to another coffee shop. The worst fights are always with the people that you can't get away from, but we can't get away from each other. There's no divorce process for nations. We are here and we are going to continue to be here, which means we need to figure out a way to live together and to love each other. Not always like each other, but to love each other and to recognize these common bonds that we do have that are necessary for making government and making, you know, the alternative. I think for a long, long time, and the EU is part of this project, but there's the libertarian projects, that people thought that the opposite of nationalism was internationalism, right? And I think that what we're discovering is that the opposite of nationalism is particularism, or it is, you know, these kind of vicious, these vicious movements that arrive, the street fighting from the left and right, that those are the things that happen when you do not have a nation that allows us to feel like, okay, well, there's a common us and we just kind of can't do that because we're all in this together. We do need that. Doesn't mean we need a huge overwhelming government state that is in every little business of our lives. And it also doesn't mean that we need, you know, a minarchist state that does nothing, but we do need something, and we need to figure out together collectively what that something will be. not by trying to rig elections so that our side wins them, and not by trying engaging in this kind of fantasy where one day you wake up and the other side's just not there anymore, which is something that you've seen quite a lot of in this country, but by recognizing that, like, we're all in this together. And, you know, at the end of the day, that for all of the men, I am as capable as anyone else of pointing out the many, many flaws of all of the Americans who are not like me. But these are, at the end of the day, they are the people who, when the chips are down and everything goes wrong, these are the ones who will have your back because you're an American and so are they.
My guest today has been Maggie McArdle. We've been talking about the book Where We Are by Roger Scruton. Megan, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thanks for having me, Russ.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.